on the transmission line is called the velocity of propagation. Now, that's something to be taken into consideration, which I would feel that most people don't think about. You know, because when you're determining matching impedances, you got to take into consideration the velocity of propagation, because it makes the line, and these are in my own words, by the way, it makes the line electrically longer or shorter, depending on, you know, what you're doing with it. So, in regard to velocity of propagation, it depends on the inductance and capacitance of the line. And, as you know, an inductor has a retarding influence on increase in current, and a capacitor has a retarding influence on an increase in voltage. Therefore, as the radio signal passes along the line, a specific amount of time is required to charge each of the individual capacitors. This means that a specific amount of time is required by the radio signal to travel from the generator end to the load end. So it does not travel in the same speed as free space, which is, I think, 300 million meters per second. So neglecting the losses in the dielectric separating the two wires in the transmission line, when the inductance and capacitance values of the line are very low, the velocity of propagation approaches that of the speed at which the radio signal is carried through space, which again, 300 million meters per second, like I just said. The velocity of propagation of the radio signal along a transmission line can be reduced to a low value by using a line of high inductance and capacitance. And from what I recall, velocity factors are in the percentage, and it's usually a point something. It's, I think, for RG8 cable, it's 0.6 or 0.8% or something around that number comes to mind. Okay, any questions? And I'll let it drop. WHCDM.
KD2FIU. Andy, listening, and keep going. Great job.
Okay, well, all I'm doing is reading. So, I'm just reading, and hopefully you can grasp some of the stuff that I'm talking about here. Thanks. All right, so to understand how an RF signal propagates along a transmission line, let us assume that the line is infinitely long. In other words, it continues on forever. While such an infinite line cannot exist, the idea helps us grasp how a line behaves. If we were able to see a radio signal moving along an infinite line, it would appear as shown in Figure 4. Now, I can't show you Figure 4, but you would see a sine wave traveling in a direction from, let's say, left to right, and it would just keep on traveling as a small little sine wave along the length of the line at different points of the line. Hopefully you could just visualize. I'm sure everybody knows what a sine wave looks like. You know, an AC signal, no matter what frequency it is, we're not talking about frequency, we're just talking about an AC waveform, which is a sine wave. So if you draw a straight line, and along the line you just make a squiggly line looking like a sine wave, that's what it looks like. All right, let me let it drop. Okay, so the signal waveform begins at the generator and moves along the line. It requires a specific amount of time for the signal to reach a specified point along the line. And it shows different points. Point one in the illustration that I'm seeing. The wave then, okay, continues on forever as shown, you know, at point C, at point A, B, C, and D, and so on. So it'll be a continuous wave and going on forever and ever and ever, infinitely long. Okay, then let it drop again. For a given line and frequency, the spacing between the crests that the crest is always the same. Okay, so that the crest will be the peak of each sine wave. So the crest will be the same, but the position of the crest will continue to change throughout the radio cycle. And this is shown by the dotted line. So they show a dotted line how the, you know, it's a wave that's moving along the line. The spacing between the crest stay the same, but the wave is moving along the line as the wave propagates down the line. So if you visualize that, that would be a good what I'm explaining would give you a good visualization of that. Okay, again, maybe let it drop. So this is shown by the dotted line, as I just said. At any point along the line, the phase of the signal will also change throughout a 360-degree cycle. And that's, again, it's shown by a dashed vertical line as in figure 4. So you're going to get a phase shift because as the wave moves, the phase is going to keep changing. And, you know, a sine wave has a 360 degrees throughout the cycle of the sine wave, starting at zero and going through its peak and valley. It goes to 90, then 180, which is at zero, and then 270, and then 360. By the way, I'm not reading that, I'm just explaining it. And that's, you know, the 360 degrees in the sine wave. Okay, so at any point along the line, the phase of the signal will also change throughout a 360-degree cycle, as shown by the dashed vertical line. The number of times that any point along the line goes through a full cycle each second depends on the signal frequency. So now we're getting into the, you know, the frequency that we're sending into the line. So obviously the higher the frequency, the crests were going to be they're going to be shorter in length. As the frequency goes up, as the frequency goes down, the crests are going to be longer in length. So thus, I'm reading this again, thus if a 1 megacycle signal is present on the line, a point will go through 1 million cycles each second. Okay, questions up to this point? W2CDO.
Can you explain velocity factor, the fact that the wave travels different in the coaxial?
Yeah, actually, it's, let's see, the next couple of paragraphs we're going to talk about velocity factor, so I'll be talking about that in a minute or two.
Does the phase angle change from two ends in the transmission line, or just from one end?
I didn't get the question, Wesley. And good evening to you. What was that again? What, repeat it.
I'm having a question about phase angle. If we say that, let's say, the phase angle changed from two ends, right? The question is it? And if it is, then why does the phase angle change at the two ends in the transmission line?
The phase angle changes continuously through a transmission line at all points.
The question was, why does the phase angle change at two ends in the transmission line?
The phase angle changes as the wave propagates. Every point has its own phase.
Andy?
Yeah, hello, Ed. I wasn't sure if you were listening. Well, yeah, Ed explained it, and I just did. You know, again, Wesley, if you visualize the way I just explained it, you'll see how, you know, the wave is moving at any given point. You know, just keep your eyes on one point, you'll see the wave move along the line. And as it moves, the phase angle will keep changing from zero up to 360. It'll just keep on moving, changing. So, that's it. All right, let me continue with this next few paragraphs because these are pretty important, and I'm doing this slowly so everyone can get a clear visualization of what really goes on. I'm trying to keep it simple. I don't want to get into any math or anything else because it gets too complicated. This is all on the surface stuff, but it gives everyone an idea, or most people an idea of what you know what's going on inside a coax cable. So let me just let it drop, and I'll just continue.
Okay. Just a few words to the person who made the comment.
KC2FYJ with a comment.
Okay, you guys doubled, but I got Harry. Go ahead.
I think the easiest way to visualize what's going on is to draw a straight line on a piece of paper, and then on a piece of transparency, draw a sine wave, and then put the transparency over the straight line and slide the transparency to the right. Keep your eye at one spot on the straight line, and you'll see what's going on at that point. And you'll also see what's going on at infinitely other points along the straight line simultaneously.
And also me. I will serve the answer every that was not addressing properly my question. The question was why face angle change from two ends, and that was my concern. The last answer is very much right. Let me know.
VDH with a comment.
Okay. Assuming that you are considering an alternating current AC transmission line, the phase angle at the two ends in a transmission line changes because of the transmission line has characteristic inductance and capacitance, and that was not mentioned. The inductance causes an AC current to lag relatively to applied AC voltage, while the capacitance causes an AC current, electric current, to advance relatively to applied AC voltage. The higher the current transmitted through the line feed at given load, the higher the phase shift between two ends. Thank you.
Let me just grab it. WHCDO.
Right.
Well, Wesley, you just made a statement, but I don't know if you were even listening, because what you just said, I said just a couple of paragraphs ago about the capacitance and the inductance, and you said it wasn't mentioned, and I mentioned it, right? So I'm just letting you know, I don't know if you just joined us or what, but I just brought it up, so a few paragraphs ago, just to clarify that. You know, I don't mean to be harsh. I want to move on with the next few paragraphs. So I'll take, I think I have VDH with a question, but I want to move on. And I already said what you just asked, Wesley, just to let you know. You thought maybe you missed it. John, go ahead. Give it to you.
Okay, fine, business. I won't take too much time. I think what Wesley is referring to is the fact that a time delay that the coaxial cable or transmission line has, if you just feed a DC pulse, you see a time delay. With a sine wave, the time delay manifests as a phase shift. For example, at 10 megahertz, one cycle takes 100 nanoseconds. So if you have a 10 nanosecond delay, that's a tenth of a cycle or a 36 degree phase shift. So time delay for DC pulse shows up as a phase shift for a sine wave. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Twitch.
Okay, was that Lou? I wasn't sure. Whose call was that?
Yeah, NY2H. And yeah, you mentioned characteristic impedance, you mentioned the surge impedance, you talked about the lumped circuits, you talked about capacitance, inductance, you talked about how voltage leads current, current leads voltage. So it was all said. So I'm just affirming what you said.
Yes, Andy said that, but the person who was responding was giving incorrect answer, and that was probably the computer. Thank you.
Okay, all right, very good. Yeah, there's a formula T, time equals 1 divided by the frequency, or frequency equals time divided by 1, just the opposite. T equals 1 over F. If you want to figure out the frequency, if you want to figure out the time, you divide it into 1, you can get microseconds, nanoseconds, picoseconds, whatever it is. And there were instruments that actually measure time delays, which is a time delay reflectometer, which I happen to have. And they're very useful instruments, but we're not going to go into that right now. We will discuss that at a later time. Let me just continue about velocity factor, because that's the paragraph that's coming up. So we're going to talk about velocity factor a bit. Let me just let it drop. Okay, so the last thing I said is, if a 1 megacycle signal is present on the line, a point will go through 1 million cycles per second. You know, just keep in mind, I'm trying to keep this whole thing simple to make sure that people understand the basics of this. So, the wavelength of the signal on the line determines the physical spacing between any two adjacent and instantaneous crests. This physical separation along the infinite transmission line is not the same as the wavelength in free space because of the lower velocity of propagation of the signal along the transmission line compared to the speed at which it travels through space. As a result, the formula for wavelength, okay, which is velocity of propagation divided by the frequency, requires a correction factor. So if you want to measure the wavelength, okay, you got to add this correction factor when applied to wavelengths along a transmission line. And the formula then becomes wavelength equals velocity divided by frequency times a constant, which is a correction factor, K, which is referred to as the velocity factor. And coax cables have that as a specification in some cases, if not all. I've seen that specification mentioned as far as what the velocity factor would be. So you need to add that into the actual formula for wavelength as the velocity factor divided by frequency times... or I should say velocity divided by frequency is what I meant, times the velocity factor. You have to add that factor in. Now that's important because when you want to, see now, getting back to our discussion in QST about using certain coax cables as impedance transformers, you got to take that into consideration. It's one of the reasons why I'm jumping into this discussion now, to get a better understanding of what velocity factor is for everyone who didn't know that. So it's important to keep that in mind. Okay, just with that, any questions? All right, good. Time is moving on. The correction factor K is referred to as the velocity factor and is determined largely by the characteristics of the dielectric material between the conductors of the transmission line. When air is used as a dielectric and the inductance and capacitance are kept low, the velocity of propagation along the line is almost the same as in free space, which, by the way, is the reference of free space would be velocity of propagation would be 1, and anything less than 1 is point something, and that's what the specification is for the coax cable that's being used. These are my own words, by the way. Okay, so let's see. The velocity of propagation along the line is almost the same as in free space. However, when some insulating material other than air, such as polyethylene, or insulated spaces are used, the velocity of propagation decreases. The influence on the velocity factor on the velocity of propagation is shown in this figure that's shown here, figure 5. So they show different velocity factors of 1 being air, or velocity factor of 0.833, which happens to be for 300 ohm twin lead. That's what it specifies here. Or for coax cable, and this is a number that's common because I've seen this, the 50 to 72 ohm coax cable has a approximate velocity factor of 0.66. It says 0.667, and of course that can be measured. You know, that can be measured with a time domain reflectometer. You want to actually measure it. So the velocity of the speed is actually less than what's going through air, which is the velocity factor of 1, which would have a velocity factor of 1. Okay, up to that point, or this point, any questions?
NGWB2EAD.
Okay, how am I doing so far, Ed?
You're doing great, Andy. You're doing great. Just a little point, a little frill. An airline usually uses some polyethylene or similar spaces, which does slow it down a little bit, but not as much as coax. And by the way, just to be an absolute pain-in-the-butt purist, radio waves actually travel a tiny bit slower in the air than they do in a vacuum. And believe me, I found that one out the hard way.
Okay, well, I haven't made that experiment, given that I have not been in a vacuum too often, but that's an interesting point. So the air itself will slow it down, even though especially I would think at a high frequency, or the higher the frequency, the more critical it becomes. So that makes sense. Okay. Well, we can have a further discussion on that. All right, let me continue this, because there's a few other things that I want to mention regarding some of these things that we're talking about. Let me let it drop again. Okay, so unfortunately they're showing, you know, as I said, they're showing some diagrams here of different types of cable with different velocity factors, and they're comparing air to 300 ohm twin lead and then to coax cable, the ones that we're familiar with, this 50 to 72 ohm coax, and that's what it says with the velocity factors. The time indicated is T1, again, going according to the diagram here, and the frequency are the same in each case. So the frequencies of these three waves that they're showing, these three coax cables, the frequency is the same. Let's see, figure 5A shows the distance that a wave will travel along a transmission line with a dielectric. When the dielectric is air, the velocity factor for air is 1. As the velocity factor becomes less compared to air, the velocity of propagation becomes lower and lower. As, and of course, again, in illustrations B and C that I have here, the effects of the lower velocity factors are shown by the shorter physical spacing between the crests along the line and the shorter distance traveled in a given at a given time. And it actually, you know, it shows that it looks like the waves is, as the velocity factor increases, the wave crests, the distance is getting shorter and shorter. Like, it's almost like the wave is increasing in frequency. Okay, so thus, as the velocity factor value decreases, the electrical wavelength or separation between the signal crest along the transmission line becomes physically shorter than the wavelength of the same at the same signal frequency measured in free space. So that's an interesting concept, and I see, because it looks like, you know, the frequency has changed, even though the frequency hasn't changed. It's just that because of the velocity factor through the cable itself, the frequency has changed. Now, just keep in mind, when you measure the actual length of a coax, piece of coax cable, if you want to match impedances, which we're going to go back to, Okay, this has, again, this has to be taken into consideration as far as the wavelength of the coax cable is concerned. Okay, so it's important to keep that in mind, that you just don't cut the cable as if you're just cutting a piece of cable. You got to take this into consideration. That's one of the reasons why I'm mentioning this, because it's important. Okay, any questions up to this point? WA2CDO. Okay, well, I guess we're all experts at this, like I am. Well, I try to be. All right, so here, current voltage current voltage relationships. So far in our discussions, we have assumed that the transmission line contained no losses. Actually, as a signal travels along an incident transmission line, its energy level or power decreases with an increase in distance from the generator, which is what we mentioned earlier. There will be attenuation, and that's because of resistance losses and because of capacitance losses and dielectric losses and other losses in the cable itself. Again, that's my words. The transmission line is not a perfect device, and therefore a certain amount of power is dissipated along the length of the line. The amount of line attenuation depends on the physical construction and the electrical constants of the line. For a given line, the amplitude of the voltage and current waveforms decrease as they travel along the line, and there's a diagram which shows that. The attenuation in the transmission line is usually measured in terms of dB. And that was your question, Rich, so this just answered your question. It's measured in dB per unit length at a given frequency. In the case of RF transmission lines, the unit of length is usually 100 feet. The greater the attenuation to 100 feet at a given frequency, the greater the attenuation will be along the line, and hence the lower the voltage, current, and power level at the end of the line. It is of interest to note that the attenuation per unit length increases with frequency, and thus is often several times as high as high frequencies as it is at lower frequencies. Okay, so I think that answers Wesley's question as far as attenuation and as the frequency changes, frequency increases along the line. Okay, I got, another page and a half. I'll see if I can do this in a half an hour. Any questions up to this point? WA2CDO.
K2GJE.
I knew there'd be somebody out there. Go ahead.
Okay, just want to clarify velocity factor. If I want to match, let's say, 75 ohms to 300 ohms, I can do it with a half wave of coax. But with a velocity factor of 0.667, that means my coax actually has to be longer. Am I right about that, over?
Yes, because the velocity factor electrically shortens the wavelength in the cable itself. You have to compensate by making that cable longer. That's right. And by the way, again, I don't want to get too far ahead, because going back to the impedance matching with transmission lines, we will discuss the formulas used to match impedances using different lengths of line of transmission lines with different impedances. You know, lines that are specified and purposely have different impedances for matching, just to let you know. By the way, what's your name, K2GJE? Is that Ed or another Ed? I don't remember.
K2GJE is Ed, over.
Okay, Ed, so we got two Eds. We got you and EAV Ed. Okay, not to be confusing. Okay, so very good. All this stuff, you know, it's good to keep in mind if somebody's, you know, wants to build an antenna and they want to use a coax cable to match impedance to it or what have you. again, just keep in mind, this is just an overview of what's going on, and it's not ground in stone with me. As I say, I'm just reading it, but I'm reading it in a precise way that maybe people can understand it, rather than making it too complicated. All right, so the next thing we'll discuss is the surge and load impedances. Okay, we mentioned surge impedance, which is characteristic impedance, as we mentioned earlier. So you have learned that a pair of spaced conductors can be thought of as being divided into small segments composed of inductance, capacitance, and resistance. The current flowing through each segment produces a voltage drop across each section, and therefore causes a current to flow in the next section, and so on down the line. Because the transmission line is formed of an almost infinite number of individual segments, the impedances measured across each segment is the same and constant. Okay, this is known as the characteristic or surge impedance of the line. And there's a formula for it. If you want to know what the formula is, the formula for surge impedance of a perfect line that has no losses is ZO, which is the impedance. That's Z is the impedance of the line, is the square root of the current, I. Is that L or I? Hold on a second, because I can't see this. L is in microhenries and C is in picofarad. That's an L. Couldn't be I, it has to be L. The square root of L over C, the inductance divided by the capacitance. So the surge impedance is the square root of the inductance divided by the capacitance. And the impedance is in ohms, the inductance is in microhenries, and that would be UUH, you know, the symbol for microhenries. And capacitance would be in microfarads, which would be picofarads. So, you see, UUH.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, let me, I just, I'm looking at the, I don't see the extra U here, so it's not microhenries, it's micro-microhenries, or picohenries, and it's a picofarad, MMS, not MS. So the inductance is in picohenries, and the capacitance is in picofarads. Okay, that's the basic formula for surge impedance. All right, any questions regarding that? WA2CDO.
WB2EAD with a quick comment.
You don't have to make it quick, you can make it long.
The characteristic impedance is actually the square root of L over C, where L is in henries and C is in farads. But if you use picofarads or micro-microfarads or picohenries, all the zeros cancel out, so you're back where you started. Just be careful. You're talking picofarads and picohenries, or microfarads and microhenries, or you're in a world of hurt.
Yeah, I don't know why they're referring it in micro-micro and pico and so on, because it could be yellow. It's just L over C, like you said. I mean, I've seen that before, but I'm just reading it as it's stated. So they could, you know, of course they cancel out, yes. You could measure that. Okay, thanks for that. I'm going to continue because it is getting a little bit late and I'm running out of time. I want to get one more segment done here. Let me let it drop. Okay, so it says, of course, all lines have losses, so this formula does not give the exact value of the characteristic impedance. However, usually the losses are so low that they do not materially affect the impedance of the line. All right. So transmission line manufacturers give the characteristic impedance of their lines, which everybody knows. You buy a piece of coax cable, you know what the impedance is. You can get 75 ohm coax or 50 ohm coax or 62 ohm coax and so on. And there's a formula for that as well, which has to do with the physical dimensions of the equally spaced lines or open wire lines or lateral lines and coax cables. So you can determine the characteristic impedance of the line by measuring the value of the inductance and capacitance with an inductor capacitor bridge. If anybody knows how to use a bridge, they can do that. The capacity is measured by connecting the bridge to the input side of the line and with the far end of the convenient length of line kept open. You know, the inductance is measured in the same way at the far end of the line shorted. Whether the line is infinitely long or some practical finite length, the line inductance and capacitance increases proportionally with line length. Consequently, the surge impedance will also have the same value regardless of the line length. Okay, now we can go over that a few times to clarify that, but not right now, because I just want to get this other two paragraphs done, and then we'll continue next week when we talk about lines with unmatched loads, meaning the formation of standing waves. Which is, now that'll get into even a deeper discussion of, you know, what a standing wave is. You know, as everybody knows, SWR. So, when a transmission line is terminated by a load equal to the characteristic impedance of the line, the transmission line section will display exactly the same characteristics as an infinite line, and we will get the most efficient transfer of energy between the generator and the load. Okay, now that's important because going back to an earlier discussion, remember I said that maximum power occurs when the impedances are matched, when the load impedance is equal to the generator impedance? That's what it says right here. You want to get the most efficient amount of energy from point A to point B by matching the impedances.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
All right, W82CDL, that was perfect. Perfect timeout. Let me let drop. Okay, so we are learning that the effective, or you have learned, that the effective inductance and capacitance per unit length of transmission line determines the characteristic impedance. These reactances are determined by the physical characteristics of the line, namely the size of the conductors, their spacing, and the dielectric constant of the insulation between them. And there are two graphs that actually show, which unfortunately I can't describe, of what it looks like at with different characteristic impedances, different wire sizes, and so on. And there is a formula which happens to be for open space. It's 276 times the log of 2 times the diameter. I'm not going to get into the formulas right now, but you can look that up on the internet as far as characteristic impedance formulas for transmission lines. So the two graphs for determining surge impedance for open wire and coaxial lines are shown here. The graph for open wire line shows an impedance of a line in relation to the diameter of each conductor and the center-to-center spacing between the conductors for various standard wire gauges and for various size tubing, if you're going to use tubing. I don't know why they said tubing, but that's interesting. The impedance formula for the coaxial type of line is shown also, and based upon the ratio between the inner radius of the outer conductor and the outer radius of the inner conductor. So you got to visualize the cross-sectional view of a coax cable looking into looking into one end, and you got to measure that those different sizes or different lengths, and then plug it into this formula, and you'll figure out the characteristic impedance of the cable. You will notice on connectors have characteristic impedances too. If you notice, like the end connectors and the PL259s, their spacing between that center pin and the shield, the body of that PL259 or end connector, that determines the impedance of that particular connector, because connectors do have impedances to them. And they do. And they're designed that way. And most people don't know that. They figure, oh, it's just a connector. It's more than just a connector. It's got an impedance to it because of the physical characteristics of it. So keep that in mind, too. All right, let me let it drop. Okay, so we're almost done here. And it's like I'm coming up to my time. The graph, okay, assumes that the dielectric medium between the two conductors is air. For other insulation materials, the impedance values will be lower, of course. All right, so the transmission lines that we have considered so far is called an untuned or non-resonant line, in which the impedances connected at the input and output of the line equal the characteristic impedance of the line. When the impedances are equal, all the energy coming down the line is absorbed by the load. In other words, when the energy reaches the termination, the line acts as though it extends into infinity because there is no longer any traces of the energy delivered to the load. All the energy is dissipated by the load. Now, again, we're saying that when the impedances are matched, keep that in mind too. Since the impedances are equal, the current at the input of a non-resonant line and at the output are also equal. If you know the surge impedance of the line and the current in the line at the output end, you can easily compute the power. And I think, Rich, BZ, you asked that question. You can compute the power that is being supplied by using the formula, the formula of P equals I squared R. So suppose the line has a surge impedance of 73 ohms and the current at the output is 7 amps. Therefore, the power simply to the line is therefore 7 squared, that's I squared, times 73, which is 3,577 watts. So, you know, keep that in mind too. When you have an equal, if you have an impedance match, you know, your surge impedance, characteristic impedance matches your load, you can figure out your power right then and there. Now, any other power factor, any other power formula can be used to compute the power fed to the line, depending on which factors, voltage, current, and resistance are known. If you know the voltage across the line and the line impedance, use the formula P equals E squared over R. On the other hand, if you know the current in the line or the voltage across the line, you can use the formula P equals E times I. So there you got your power formulas that you could use depending on, you know, what information is given to you, because there are three power formulas. Okay, so we are done for today. Perfect timing, it's 10 to 10. And we're going to go talk about next week lines with
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, I timed it out for the last time. WA2CDL, let it drop.
Andy, I have a point. WB2AB.
Okay, let me just finish this, because I'm done. At least this week. So, next week we're going to talk about what happens when lines are unequal impedances in the transmission line. So far, we've been talking about equal impedances where things are matched. Now we're going to go into unmatched impedances. Hence, talking about SWR and formation of standing waves and so on. So that would be another interesting discussion. Okay, before I head, I'll stand by 1 second. Any other questions as we're wrapping it up for today?
Would you like some trivia? Hey, it's K2GJE.
W2TTT with suggestion.
Okay, I gotta go downstairs and get a shot of vodka or something because my voice is going out. Okay, it's Gordon, W2TTT, we got you, we got Ed, GJE. So first, we got the other Ed, EAV. EAV standby. GJE, go ahead with yours, and then give it back to me.
Just some quick trivia. W2ER, he's now a silent G. His name was Marshall Etter. He was the last radio engineer for RCA at their place called Radio Central. He said that wire antennas should be fed with wire. He meant open wire line. We'll get into that another day. Also, Radiax was not the original antenna that the Transit Authority tried. The original antenna that they tried in the tunnels looked like about 600 ohms. Over.
Yes, I know that. They actually used a form of twin lead. It was a parallel conductor line. It was not Radiax. And that's what I heard. I heard about that. In fact, there is one location, which I know about, which still has a piece of that still there. And only I know that. I know exactly where it is because I've seen it. I've been down in the tunnels because that's what I do, by the way. So I work on the radio system in transit. That's why I brought that up. So I know about that. Very good, Ed. Thank you for that information. Let me give it over to Gordon with a couple of questions or suggestions, and then we'll go from there. W2TTT, WA2CDO.
Yeah, well, I've been listening, and I wasn't able to comment until now because I just don't have a great location, but I just wanted to say thank you, and B, suggest that when you talk about mismatched stuff, that not just turn in terms of SWR, but speak of it in terms of return loss in DV. I think that will bring to light what's being given up. So just think about it in terms of return loss and equate return loss to SWR, et cetera, and what the impedance mismatches could be. I think when you get to that, that'll be really, really good. And look forward to your next talk. Thank you again, W2CTT. Just out to on a milk run, literally.
I missed the last part. What did you say, the last sentence, the last 10 seconds, Gordon? What was that?
I'm out on a milk run. Over.
Oh, okay, you're the milkman for the night. Oh, okay. Yeah, your signal's holding up. There's a lot of flutter, but I hear it. Okay, fine. Yeah, thanks. You know, as I said, you know, for the general audience, keep in mind, I'm trying to give bite-sized information because, you know, it gets... you build on it each week. So this is like an episode. You know, each week you learn more and more, but you got to build on what you know the previous week, because it helps, you know, like being in school, I guess. Actually, it's a refresher course for me, too. So, especially if you don't work with this stuff, because you forget. All right, Ed, you're the last guy. WB2AAV, over to you. WA2CDO.
WB2AAV, yeah. By the way, the term Ilfron became somewhat famous in World War II, where it was used to mean any kind of a mission where you had less enemy resistance than expected. All right, now here's what I want to say. So we're talking about cable loss in decibels per 100 feet at a particular frequency. One interesting factor in that really doesn't get attention it deserves is that there is a very direct equation correlating the loss of a cable with the price at the end of the priceless column, because a quality coaxial cable involves very expensive materials. Nobody wants to pay all that much, and so it becomes a trade-off, is how far will we give up performance to save some money? Back to Andy.
Yeah, WA2CDO, I understand that. There's a whole science to the manufacturing and testing of coax cables. I happen to have I happen to be fortunate. I'm trying to get the words right. I happen to have been fortunate to have taken a tour to the Times Wire factory. They're in Wallingford, Connecticut. And Wallingford is not too far away. I think it's on the, what is that called? Merritt Parkway, I believe. Route 15, I think it is. The Merritt Parkway. So it's up there somewhere, if I recall. This was, this must have been about 10 years ago, at least. And I had a chance to tour the plant. With a group of people, and they explained and they showed how the coax cables are made and how they test them after they're made using network analysis and so on. There's a whole procedure to this. So yes, there's different quality coax. There's different braid factors, you know, percentage of braid covering the coax, covering the dielectric. You know, you got 90% braid, 70% braid, 100% braid, you have double shielded, you have triple shielded, there's all different types of coax out there, and of course, the higher the quality, the more you're going to pay. So, it depends on your application. If you're going to play around with HF, the low frequency, maybe it's not that critical, you know, for your application. If you're going to play around with UHF and VHF, you want a better quality cable. So, that's also to keep in mind, that's very good. Okay. Good night, guys. Have a good week. Don't fight too much. It's 10 o'clock, and I'm going to go to sleep because I have to go to work tomorrow. Thank you for letting me back in. We'll continue next week with another edition of Andy's Corner, which I'm going to go back to right now. I'm going back to my corner. Roy, AC2GS, thank you. Back to you. And have a good week. WHCDL.
Well, thank you very much, Andy. It was another great Andy's Corner, and I'm looking forward to next week's Andy's Corner. I have a little question for SWB2EAV. I think you're going to have to put a correction factor into that equation of yours because it sort of depends upon the diameter of the cable. You know, you get something like LMR95, it's probably more expensive than a less lossy, thicker coax.
Well, we're talking about power handling capacity, frequency, and then, given those two, you get into loss per 100 feet, and you'll find they all correlate with the price. And I think it's an exponential thing, because as the loss goes to zero, the price goes to infinity.
Well, you know, I'd have to call up JPL and find out how much they price their superconducting coaxial cables for.
My point exactly.
Yeah, I agree with you. The rubber meets the road with theoreticals when you actually have to pay for that type of equipment. It might be theoretically possible, but no one that I know around here has the scratch to buy any of that stuff.
I do want to give you an example of that. Some, like, really fancy, like, radio astronomy receivers, they spend incredible amounts of money on that kind of stuff. Also, the SR-71 spy plane could do amazing things, but getting it to do it took an unbelievable amount of work and material.
Well, fortunately, defense budgets are expandable, so money isn't as important to those guys. You know, I forgot how much the toilet bowl supposedly cost on the ISS.
By the way, did you hear me make this comment about how radio waves travel a little below, a little slower in the air than a vacuum?
Yes, I utterly, totally agree with you. I mean, it's a very, very small difference, so it's something like a velocity factor of 0.999 something. You know, it depends on how many integers you want to go out to. But I totally agree. Matter of fact, I linked a page of the velocity factors of different coaxial cables. If someone's interested, go to my link page, roy.ac2gs. There are websites that give you the attenuation per 100 feet, and there are web pages that also give you the velocity factors for the different dielectric materials.
Now, Roy, should I tell you the test setup I used to confirm that?
Certainly.
It involved two airplanes a couple of hundred miles apart, both with GPSs, and one with a radar.
Okay.
NY2H, what did you use for the control group of free space without any air? Well, that was just theoretical.
No, in all seriousness, the data analysis of some flight tests was showing some very small errors that we couldn't explain. So somebody said, wait a minute, have we corrected? Have they taken into account the fact that light travels, radio travels a little bit slower through the air than it does through a vacuum? And you got some very sheepish looking grins. They cranked in the numbers and the problem went away.
NY2H, question?
Yeah, Lou, you want to ask add a question?
On humidity and barometric pressure?
The answer is very complex and very detailed. Here it is. Yep, you got it. It varies with all that.
All right. Good job by you.
Okay, another little physics problem is that if you get a physicist drunk and very verbal, he'll kind of tell you that light only propagates at the speed of light in the vacuum. So although we perceive different speeds, it's more of a phase relationship, interference phenomena, rather than the electromagnetic wave actually just slowing down in the medium. But I'm sure people will argue with that. Okay, I guess no one's going to argue with that. Let me once again mention I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limewire Technical Net. If you have any technical questions at this time, you can ask them. If you want to try Science Talk du jour, I have a list of topics, canned topics, that we can discuss, or we can discuss the COVID virus, or we can play a puzzle if anyone is so inclined. Okay, the silence is deafening. Let's try for a puzzle. In the old days, people sort of liked the puzzle, and this goes back to things that I particularly like to babble on about. Quantum mechanics is a curious thing. And there is a line from Richard Feynman in which he kind of said that if someone tells you they understand quantum mechanics, it means they don't understand quantum mechanics. And probably it even goes farther back to guys like Niels Bohr, who is one of the fathers of quantum mechanics. So tonight I thought I would bring up a rather interesting concept called quantum tunneling. Quantum tunneling is where an object is sitting in front of a barrier and can get to the other side of the barrier without going through the barrier. It just basically pops out of existence and then pops back in existence on the other side. Let me drop. Now, you might ask, is this some strange lab experiment? Is this a bunch of guys with equations? It does actually have a very practical value. If you turned off quantum tunneling, the sun would stop burning because part of the process of fusion of protons two protons will fuse into deuteron nuclei, and then the two deuteron nuclei will merge into a helium-4. And if you don't have tunneling, you don't really have the first part, so the sun would go out. Let me drop for a sec. So the point of this little discourse on quantum tunneling is to ask the question, do any of you people out there have devices in your home that require quantum tunneling to actually work? You know, not esoteric equipment, not stuff on the sun, not stuff at Los Alamos, but in your kitchen, in your living room, wherever. Anyone have any?